Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. And our third annual Franchise Legal Series continues right here on Blog Talk Radio. And again, we have as our guest Michael Webster. We'll be introducing him in a little bit. Michael's been on the show. This will be our third time. He's been on each of the legal series, and we're definitely looking forward to hearing what he has to say. And, of course, the brainchild of the Franchise Legal Series, our co-producer, Joe Caruso. Joe, how are you today?
Fantastic, Paul. Glad to be part of the legal series and franchise today, and we're almost through the whole series.
Yep, this is our sixth of seven, and of course next week we have the IFA Legal Symposium recap, and the first five segments have been absolutely great. Why don't you give us a recap, Joe, and also tell us what to expect next week.
Fantastic. I'm happy to do so, Paul. We started the series this year with Lane Fisher doing a show on private equity and franchising, due diligence and deal making, followed on by Lee Plave, who helped us discuss social media and technology, a moving target for franchising. Then Mark Kirsch, safety and vigilance, leveraging franchise sales outsourcing. And then Warren Lewis came back with franchise compliance basics and earnings claims, and he made his franchise seller's handbook available to all the listeners. So I encourage people who didn't listen to that show, go listen to the podcast, and you can find out how to get a copy of the book signed by Warren Lewis. And then we had Ken Prine, very, very interesting show, litigation and technology and franchising. It's complicated. Ken's an expert in information law and e-discovery, and he really made an impact with what he had to say about that topic and how it relates to franchising activities. And today, of course, we've got dynamics of winning franchisee-franchisor relationships with Michael Webster. And then bringing us to the conclusion of the series, last but not least, we're going to have Ursa Jackson talk about the IFA Legal Symposium, and the topic of her show will be what do franchise lawyers talk about?
Well, it's certainly just been a tremendous series, and of course, as we wrap up next week, we'll be going on summer break, and you'll be able to listen every Thursday to the replays from this legal series as well as key segments of other legal series. Before we move forward, I'd like to give a shout-out to all the franchise professionals attending Frank Connection 2012 in Washington. If you haven't already got there or when you get ready to go home, safe travels to all, as well as safe travels to all the legal professionals that are out there that will be attending next week's IFA Legal Symposium, also in Washington, D.C. So, you know, our guest today is Michael Webster, a Toronto-based franchise attorney and chair of the Strategic Committee of the International Association of Franchisees and Dealers. Michael earned his law degree at the University of Toronto. Additionally, he has a PhD in philosophy and economics from the University of Waterloo, and he was a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford University, focusing on game theory, negotiation, training, and critical thinking. Michael, welcome back again to Franchise Today.
Oh, thanks very much. I enjoy this show, and you've had some terrific people on so far. I hope I can keep up to the pace you've set.
I'm sure you will.
Hey, Michael, this is Joe. I'm curious, before we get into the topic of today's show, dynamics of winning franchisee-franchisor relationships, I noticed you updated your LinkedIn profile with a greater emphasis on negotiation. Why did you make that change? Why did you think that was important?
Well, thanks, Joe, for noticing. I took some advice from one of our key partners, Victoria Ypres, and emphasized what I thought was really important. Franchise operators are in sales, and many of the larger corporations, such as Microsoft, FedEx, now train their sales staff in traditional sales methods, and then give them courses in negotiation. It's really focused on communication. Negotiation is a way of communicating when you're trying to get a sale. So they moved beyond the standard, very important sales training. And I thought it important to signal to franchisees and franchisors that we can provide this type of training for them. And it, you know, it's aimed at, of course, improving the unit economics. A better salesman is just going to make more money. So I thought that was an important observation by Victoria. And since it happens to be a longstanding expertise of mine, thought I should tell the world about it a little bit more.
You know, I failed to mention the topic to all the listeners of today's show, which is dynamics of winning franchise relationships. And, you know, for many franchisors, Michael, there's no greater fear than having to deal with an independent group of franchisees who may be disgruntled or at a minimum unhappy with the franchisor and the business model, and basically the breakdown of the franchise relationship. And I know from your previous appearances on Franchise Today and discussions that you and Joe and I have had on this topic, you have a polar opposite view that defies franchising conventional wisdom. So why don't you share with us, why should a franchisor want to deal with an independent franchisee association, and allow me to emphasize the phrase, want to deal with an independent franchisee association?
Well, there's a short answer. They want to deal with them before they become a litigation group. That's the most important observation, that you are, as a franchisor, you're already dealing with an informal group of franchisees who talk, complain, make suggestions, and are doing and are talking amongst themselves. They have political factions that you have to deal with. You, as a franchisor, try to communicate with them, but you have no idea who's listening. No idea. So you already have this informal association of franchisees. You need a better communication structure, because communication, as we all know and believe, miscommunication is at the heart of all of our litigation problems. Unless, of course, you're just a straight fraud. But we're not talking about franchisors like that. We're talking about serious people who are trying to communicate something to their franchisees. So that's the first thing. You already have a group. It's important for you to deal with that group in a professional manner. Second thing is that franchisees need to be told, and it comes better from them, that they as a group have collective responsibilities, right? The franchisor is not their employer. The franchisor is a franchisor. And the franchisor has certain duties and obligations, some of which are laid out in the agreement, some of which are laid out in the operations manual. But there's a whole set of goods and services, a supply of which the franchisees have to join together to provide for themselves. They need to be reminded of those collective responsibilities. And a franchisor doesn't have the necessary credibility to remind them of those collective responsibilities absent an independent franchisee association. And the third, you know, real benefit is, if you're a founder, there's only one group that's going to keep your memory alive, and that's the franchisees. The franchisees are the people who have that inordinate attachment to the brand. And when the founder leaves for whatever reasons, and you get a public or a large private equity investor, none of those people care about the brand in the way that the franchisees do. And the only way that you can keep that love of the brand going is through an independent franchisee association. So those are the reasons why you really want to deal with a franchisee association. But having said that, you don't want any group that claims to be a franchisee association. You don't have to deal with them just because they say they are a franchisee association.
So let's clear up for some of the listeners that haven't listened to some of the previous legal series when we discussed franchisee associations. What's the difference between franchisee associations and, let's say, franchise advisory councils?
Sure, that's a good question, because a lot of franchisors say, well, I already have my advisory group. And let us cut to the quick here. We all know what franchisee advisory groups are for. They're to say to the franchisor, yes, sir, yes, madam, your ideas are wonderful. Could we have that lovely steak dinner now? Huh? Franchisor advisory councils are there primarily to give some support to the franchisor. They do not provide and are not designed to provide that critical overview or skepticism of the franchisor's plans. You know, if I invited you into my boardroom and the first thing that you did was to, remark excessively critically about my plans, I'm not inviting you back. You're especially not getting that very nice steak dinner you were promised. Now, the Independent Franchisee Association is under no such constraints. They require, it's part of their mentality to point out the blind spots and the errors and the inefficiencies of the franchisor's ideas. They have to do so in a constructive manner if they ever want to be invited back to the table. But that's the difference. And there's rooms for both. Both of those functions are needed. I don't believe you can have, at an advisory council once your system becomes complex enough.
So this is definitely one of those cases where the meaning of various franchise terminology isn't one and the same. So there's a distinct difference between franchisee associations and franchise advisory councils. Just want to make that clear for the listeners, because I know there's still a lot of confusion. Like you said, franchises will say, oh, I've already got, my group. It's not the same. Also, to your point, you mentioned a key phrase in your answer just a couple of minutes ago with respect to franchisees are not employees of the franchisor. And as we know, there's been, the recent lawsuit regarding janitorial franchise Coverall, it's well publicized this week in Forbes magazine, and it says that janitorial franchise Coverall is receiving a $3 million bill from the Massachusetts court this week in a lawsuit other franchisors are watching closely. If you would, can you give us a quick summary of your opinion on this franchise nightmare, the scandal at Coverall?
Sure. First of all, Paul, I've written about this, and I want to write about it I just want to talk about one issue, and that is the centralized billing. Coverall collects the money that franchisees bill for and then remits that money, less deductions, back to the franchisee. This is a model that many, many franchisors use, not as quite as blatantly, but they, with an electronic transfer, they effectively are doing the same thing. And what Massachusetts found, and this is undoubtedly a political decision, no one should think otherwise, that arrangement constituted an overreach. It was Coverall was misclassifying its independent operators, i.e., franchisees, when they really were employees. They centered on this central billing idea. Now, I say it's a political decision because had Massachusetts not been in a deficit position, they're not so interested in trying to collect $3 million in a hard legal fight against Coverall. But they are. And many franchisors are missing the big picture here. Coverall provided one example of an overreach, one way you could misclassify your independent operators or franchisees and the state find them as employees. And then you're subject to a bunch of penalties. Well, that's one way the overreach was found. There are many possible overreaches in each state who's facing a budget problem, like all of them, are going to look hard at the biggest franchisor in their state. Can we get money from them? Have they become an employer? Have they exercised so much control over their franchisees that they should be paying a bunch of payroll taxes? Now, if I'm a franchisor, I want to avoid that like the plague.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want the Attorney General of any state coming around and saying, I'd like to see some documents. That's not a friendly phrase. So, I think that the Coverall case, they could have helped themselves had they had an independent franchisee association that owned the collective, billing platform. And they could have achieved many other strategic goals had that happened. And it would have been harder then to say that they were, an employer. And I think that's the big long-term story that franchisors have to keep in mind. Coverall was not about a janitorial franchise. It's not about churning. It is about overreach when states and federal governments are looking hard at the question, how have you classified, I'll say workers for a generic term. If you've told the state collection agencies and the IRS that these people are independent operators, i.e. franchisees, and you've exercised a great deal of control, probably on the advice of your franchisor council, you just may be an employer. You don't need that. You just don't need that.
Well, I think that entire industry segment, and I know there are others, is definitely very visible in this. Having spent 6 years consulting very closely with one of those brands, it was always my concern that the model that they chose was ripe for exercising too much control. And I thought that there was a possibility of something raising its ugly head at some point, and it looks like it's taken place. And of course, we could probably debate that and talk about it for hours on end. But anyway, I appreciate you giving us your opinion. So let's move back a second. In order for an independent franchisee association to be productive in working with a franchisor and franchisees, in your opinion, what should a franchisee association do apart from providing just communications?
Well, let me tell you the first thing that I think a franchisee association, a young one, ought not to do. They ought not immediately to attack the pricing and the supply chain. That's just going to get people annoyed, even if they have some valid concerns. What they should do is aim at the costs that they can control. For example, employee selection and human resources, employee training. Those are areas which fall squarely in the franchisees' collective interests. If you have poor employee selection and poor employee training, two things happen. You get bad customer service, which leads to fewer repeats, which leads to poor unit economics. You get high employee turnover, which is likely attracts some regulatory concern. And it's a demonstration, it's just costly to retrain those people. You cannot, as a franchisee, expect the franchisor to provide you with those platforms, those service providers that are experts in employee selection, employee training, and human resources, especially if the franchisor doesn't own a lot of units. They're in no better position than you are. So as a group, you have to find a way to get those vendors in there and charge yourself a little bit more than the vendor would charge so that you can provide the necessary administration needed to set up your association. Because the association or group of people have to provide those benefits. And, another one that's very popular right now because of digital marketing is local marketing. Hey, this is this was an area 10 years ago that nobody really paid much attention to.
Sure.
And I know that, and I know you, Paul, you've got Melee Obsley doing a local search seminar on June 14th on this very topic. And it's something that requires coordination between the franchisor and franchisees, because otherwise they'll just sit around and, tell each other, well, you ought to be doing this. No, you ought to be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
exactly.
Someone's got to do it. There are other functions that an association should be providing at the front end, site selection, lease negotiation. These are all things that the franchisor wants to have a hand in, but really doesn't want to be controlling in any significant way. And I know another platform that Joe and I are both very keen on seeing more franchisors and franchisees work on is a common accounting platform to give people the necessary benchmarks and reporting. For many, many franchisors, they have in their contract, a requirement about PL, profit and loss statements. But, if they don't get them and they get the royalties, they don't complain. Well, that's crazy. First of all, that's extremely valuable information that at a collective level you want to get. If you look at what many of the auto dealers have done over the years, they've pooled their financial data with other dealers who aren't competitors. So they're in the same dealer network, not in the same geographical region, but then they get good benchmarks and understand what they might be able to achieve in by way of increased in unit economics. And, that data, that collection of data provides a lot of benefits for both the franchisees and the franchisor. So it's another area in which you want to collaborate on.
Sure.
So those are the ones that immediately come to mind.
Mike, this is Joe. I'm kind of curious if you could be a little bit more specific on, how can the activities of a franchisee association be beneficial for both the franchisor and the franchisees?
Let me give you a real practical example because it's a system that I know of and worked with closely over many years. is a Meineke system and the Meineke Dealers Association. They have, you know, that's a tough business. That aftermarket auto parts business is tough, and I think it's a lot tougher now in the recession that we're in. But their former president, Chris Schmitz, and executive director Ron Soto, who have many years of experience, knew that they had to get in some sort of customer service program. They had found a provider who had done a great deal of this work for the hotel in the hotel industry, Mackay Solomon, who is now going to be speaking at their convention, and they hope that they'll get a critical mass of people interested in his training to have him in at their regional training next year. Now, this is, of course, you know, having more satisfied customers is something that Meineke has shown quite conclusively to the dealers, that greater satisfaction means greater likelihood to return, means better unit economics. Now, you would think that was obvious, but it's good that they took the time to actually document how that might work. So they're in favor of what the Meineke Dealers Association, MDA, is doing in terms of training. They'll support it, logistically support it. It's not something, however, that they're going to put in at this stage a great deal of money in providing that training. And the dealers themselves are going to have to come up with that money to get the training. And presumably some of the benefit will be in higher unit economics, which benefits everybody. But it's something that simply could not be brought about if the Dealers Association was completely antagonistic to Meineke's concerns. And it's not something that, unless Ken Walker, the CEO of Driven Brands, had, unless he was a supporter of what the association was doing, the franchisor would not have been on board. So you need all of those people working together. And that's an association that collectively bargains with the franchisor over terms that go into their contract. So, you know, there are some tough, tough fights that they have, and yet at the same time they can come up with this customer service program. So that's the type of things that, a mature and professional franchisee association can do for a system.
Mike, in terms of in your work with independent franchise associations and just franchising generally, what other service gap examples and functional areas are ones that could be filled or sourced by a franchisee association? What are those other types of things? And I think we're really talking about those things that the franchisor either can or won't do.
Yeah, you want to look at, from the general view, the franchisor says, look, what do I want my franchisees to have, and what can't they get from me because I don't want to be an employer? So that's, your big overview there. The second view would be, look, these guys are local experts. How can I make sure that local expertise transfers through the system? So those are where I start looking at things. Now, one great example is, human resources. If you're a small or even own two, maybe even three subways, you're going to be hard-pressed to adopt best practices that are compliant with all the federal and state legislation on employment law and human resource law. You'll be lucky if your infractions are not noticed. The franchisor would love you to be in line with those regulations, but isn't going to give you or ought not to give you their employee handbook if they have one, and they certainly ought not to be counseling you on how to deal with your employees. And that's where you know, you and I have looked at a great platform, HR Sentry. This was, again, I think this was a friend of yours or an acquaintance of yours, Paul Dean Haller.
That's correct.
Who had come to us and said, look, we've got this platform that allows a group of franchisees or a multi-unit franchisee or even a group of multi-unit franchisees to look at, have the access to all the necessary state, federal forms, have access to some of the best practices, and from a legal perspective, have the record ready to go should there be any questions about compliance. And this is a function that the Franchisee Association then should turn around and manage and sell to some but not all of its members. Not all of its members will feel the need for it, but many of its members will see the value to it. And, you know, even if it's only 15% of their members, it's still a valuable program for the association to manage. So that's the type of gaps. You know, from the franchisor side, that's a gap. From the franchisee side, it's a necessary service. And again, I go back to, you know, what Paul and I were talking about in local marketing. The worst thing is for people to stand around pointing the finger saying, you ought to be doing this for me, right? That just gets people nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a good enough example for you, Joe, or did you want a different type of example?
No, I think that's good, and I think there's some additional questions that Paul and I have planned for you that will address more of this aspect. So why don't we save it for the remainder of our questioning of you?
Yeah. We're live on Franchise Today. It's the third annual Franchise Legal Series, heads into the home stretch, and the franchise relationship is front and center today. And the focus on the dynamics of winning franchisor-franchisee relationships is being discussed with our guest, Michael Webster, along with co-producer Joe Caruso. Michael, how would you explain to the, we'll call it, unconvinced and skeptical franchisor executives listening to our discussion that franchisee associations could really be good for their business and really should be an essential strategic tool?
How can I explain? Well, who would they rather see on their doorstep? A nice smiling person like me coming to assist in improving the business unit economic models, or a snarling litigator? And I won't mention who that might be, but you can think, you can fill in the gaps. Not that there's anything wrong with snarling litigators. Some of my best friends are snarling litigators. But, you know, the reality of it all is that when your franchisees aren't listening to you, they're going to be listening to somebody else. And they're not listening to you when they're not making any money. And that's the time that you need maximum engagement from them, and you, as a franchisor, are the least credible source of information. Okay? When people aren't making money and someone comes to them who appears to be making more money than they are, off the sweat of their labor, and says, I have a plan for us, it's just not credible, right? It is not a credible plan. Now, let me give you an example where in fact, Don Fox, a Firehouse sub, went to the franchisees, because this is a bit of a counterexample to my overall thesis, but it's a but because he's a clever strategic thinker, it worked. This is a case in which the Firehouse sub franchisees were not making money. Their local marketing wasn't producing significant results. And they were at, I think, 2 points. I think that's what I talked to Don for about an hour and a half, but I don't have my notes right in front of me, but I'm remembering it was 2 points that they were throwing into the local marketing. So Don said, and this is, you know, well, I'll create a franchisee association and they will take care of it. He gave that over to them. He said, look, you take care of your own local marketing. We won't collect it. And, you know, you deal with that. Because what we are doing for you isn't working. So that's first, you know, gave up control. Very credible move. Franchisees took control, and what happened? Well, in my world, what would have happened is that the Franchisee Association, you know, then flourished and did all the right things. Now, we live in a practical world or a real world, and those things don't always happen. In this case, the franchisees flubbed it. Okay. They didn't do any better than Don did. They did worse. Okay. So now both sides are in a situation, but Don's got a lot of credibility now, right? Because he's given up control. Next move, they come back and say, Don, you got to do something. And Don says, fine, but now we got to go to 4 points or 4.5 points. Okay. So there's no way that he gets that, you know, doubling of contributions from the franchisees and buy-in from them unless he gave up control in the first place and gave them the possibility of taking it over. And in our last discussion, he related to me that their radio ads now were doing extraordinarily well. May have saturated some of their DMAs with their radio ads, and everyone's extremely happy about how that the local advertising budget is being spent. And as you know, in franchising, that's one of the most contentious issues. So there's an example in which a franchisor did everything that could have resulted in a strong franchisee association. Gave up control, handed it over to the franchisees, would have been happy that there was a franchisee solution. Franchisees were unable to deal with that, and he was able to put in a program that there was no way he was going to get had he simply tried to say, well, we need 4.5 points from everybody instead of two.
Right.
So that's the, I think that's the realistic mechanism for most franchisors who are skeptical, right? Incredibly give up control, see what the franchisees do. If they don't come up with a plan, well, then, you know, they'll come. If it's really important to them, they're going to come back and ask you to do something. And if it's not important, well, good. There's one less thing that you have to worry about.
Sure. Well, you mentioned a couple of different franchisee associations that are out there. Can you give us some other examples of franchisee associations?
Sure, and, you know, I'm going to talk about associations and purchasing co-ops as if they were the same thing. They're not. But, you know, the most, they and depending on the system, they have either a very close relationship or a not-so-close relationship. But if you start with the most famous brands that you're talking or most well-known, all of the Yum! Brands have a purchasing co-op that's franchisee-owned. Even after the sell-off of A&W and Long John Silver's, they still have those co-ops that are all run, purchasing co-ops, run and owned by franchisees with a significant franchisor input. KFC is one in which the franchisee association actually controls the advertising, even though they've had a hiccup in the States recently. You've got Dunkin' Donuts, which has DDIFO, and they have a national a supply chain now, which was critical, the national pricing, that is, which is critical to the brand's attempt to expand west of the, I guess, west of the Missouri River. Because, you know, unless there was a national pricing, people farther away from the supply chain would be paying prices that will put them at non-competitive levels with respect to their local competition. So that was a big deal for both the brand and the franchisees. I've mentioned Meineke in the hotel business. You have the Holiday Inn or Association of the Holiday Inns and other brands in that bundle. There's about overall, you know, 120, 150, if you go by what's disclosed in the Cal EV item 20, of, you know, I would call them significant franchisee associations. Our website, I think, lists 60 to 70 of those. We're constantly adding and updating those. And I want to make, you know, a distinction, again, for your listeners between, you know, a real association that's adding value to the system and a mere litigation group that's all, that says that they're adding value, but is, you know, largely dominated by the litigation concerns. Mm-hmm. And those are a dime a dozen. And many of those, even when they win the litigation, fall apart. There's a couple of new associations that came out of class actions, the Quiznos Association, and we'll just see if they're able to really follow the path that the Meineke dealers did, because they were born out of a failed class action in that case.
Sure.
But they had some significant leaders and some significantly in counsel that pushed them along into, collaboration through the difficult and hard times of collective bargaining. So, if I'm right that the overreach problem that or the misclassification problem becomes something that the IRS and states are attaching a lot more significance to, smart franchisors will have to provide a bulwark against the overreach, and they'll need franchisee associations, formal ones, because many of them, as I say, already have these informal contexts anyway, so there's no reason not to turn it into a more, you know, formal arrangement if you're protecting yourself against the IRS and state. Seems like a good idea to me.
Sure, and it seems by just the numbers that you had thrown out that franchisee associations are much more prevalent today than many franchisors would believe. What are the risks for a franchisor in recognizing a franchisee association?
Well, you know, the risks are, and this is, I think, what, you know, franchisors are rightly afraid of, is that the association has no interest, none, in assisting the development of the brand, or they have an interest, but they're incompetent, and that they simply put together a mob of people complaining, and those complainers will find, litigation resources. And I'm generally opposed to the use of litigation to solve business problems. Many of the franchise problems, and we talked about this before, are business problems and have nothing to do really with the contract until people start looking at it. And these are problems that they can work out for themselves. They may need some help in negotiation. They may need some help with simulations. They may need some help, but I do not think that they primarily need help that the courts or the relief that the courts can provide. The courts are just not interested in this level of detail about business operations. They're just not.
Sure.
And, you know, you're foolish to believe that you're going to get, on average, anything more than, you know, a cursory look from the courts. Now, of course, if it's a termination issue, yes, that's something that you do want the courts to deal with. And there are issues that need to be properly litigated. But you do not want, as a franchisor, to put together a group of people whose sole complaint or whose sole mission is, we'd like more of what you have, Mr. Franchisor. Right? That's not bargaining. If I went to you, Paul, and said, Paul, you know, I really like, you know, what you're doing, and I'd love to be a part of it, but I need more of what you have right now. You'd say, well, fascinating, Mike. Fascinating, Mike. What are you adding? Nothing. I just want more of what you have. Okay. You know, that's what many young groups of franchisees do. They focus on, you know, how much royalties they're paying, how much the supply chain costs. Instead of, they should be focusing on, well, what can we get out of this, right? What can we add as a group? What can we do together? Because no one's going to listen to you as a group if you're not adding things. So, you know, the risk to a franchisor is to get a group of people together that really aren't solving the not helping solve the franchisor's immediate business problem. I mean, a very good example of this, and I know far too much about it, was the Kurz Franchisee Association. You know, that was well funded by the franchisor, had a specific goal in mind, but by and large, the process and the people involved made that thing fail. So I don't know if the franchisor is better off or with it failed or not.
Mike, this is Joe.
Yeah.
Under the current 2008 FTC rubric, what requirements do franchisors have with regard to their franchise disclosure documents in disclosing franchisee associations? What are their duties?
Yeah, their duties are under item 20. They're to disclose the existence of any trade-related franchisee association who wants to be listed, and they're not supposed to list their franchise advisory councils. So you should be able to look at an item 20 and determine the existence, address, and contact information for the franchisee association.
Is it the duty of the franchisee to let the franchisor know they want to be listed?
Yes, that's right. You're quite correct on that. The franchisee association has to request it, and I believe on a yearly basis, please put us in the FTC, item 20. That's correct.
So, Michael, where can franchisors, franchisees, and service providers go to find out more about franchisee associations?
Well, and this is the pitch and plug, thank you very much, on our site, franchise-info.us, we have a whole list of service providers who are have various programs in which they're trying to sell to franchisees and franchisors. On our suppliers page, we've broken it down into sections. So if you're either a franchisor or a vendor, that would be a great place to start. We have a bunch of very intelligent people writing on general problems and their solutions without directly pitching their own product. Obviously, these people want to become known as authorities in the area, and they're trying very hard to engage both the franchisor and franchisee. And if you're interested as a franchisor, but you haven't made up your mind what platform or what services that you need, you'd sign up for a newsletter. Same with franchisees. You can sign up on the front page of franchise-info.us, and then you will get on a weekly basis three articles that are directed to the establishment of the provision of goods and services for those areas in which the franchisor wants the franchisees to have but is not going to provide themselves. So a lot of very smart people writing about a lot of very interesting products and services, and well worth any franchisor running through and finding out if there's a solution there for them. And of course, if they have some communication problems, we have our own communication platform that we can help them establish some independent, more credible communications, because they primarily need to know who's listening to them, because there's no point in putting out material that nobody reads or that one or two people read. And
sure,
that's one of the important changes in the internet these days. It's very easy to track who's reading and for how long.
And again, if listeners haven't seen or heard, actually hadn't heard the web address, it's franchise-info.ca. Can't remember that, go to Franchise Essentials site down the right-hand side of the page under Associations. There's a link there as well. It's the International Association of Franchisees and Dealers, and I'm proud to say that I'm a IAFD key partner. And if you would, Michael, tell us a little bit about the key partner program.
Yeah, the key partner program is, again, thanks, Walt. It's a marketing program, and it goes back to a very old view about solution selling, that if you understand your customer and understand his or her needs, they're more likely than to buy from you. Now, these days, in order to find, we provide a full-fledged website for you, but simply writing isn't good enough. You need to know who's reading you. You need to get some sort of engagement report. You need to do some sort of analytics. And at the entry-level marketing program, we provide those for you, because what we do is we get you in front of our newsletter audience of some 12,000 people and find out just who's interested in what you're trying to, what solution you're trying to inform people about. And you need to know that. You cannot simply write and wait for people to come to your website. So this is the ultimate in inbound and outbound techniques all wrapped up in one.
Mm-hmm.
And, Joe and I go over very carefully some of the, who's reading you. And as you know, Paul, that I take this, very seriously about what I think those readers are telling you about your post and how you can get better. Because it's in our interest for you to get better, because as you get better, you'll demand more services from us and other key partners. And as they provide those better services, you'll get better. So it's a nice virtuous circle. As, George
and does
Soros
it cost anything for individuals to subscribe to updates and newsletters?
No, if you want to be a reader, Of course, you know, you simply subscribe to the newsletter, subscribe to the blog, or subscribe to individual threads, individual posts. All of those are, of course, for free. If you actually want to do some marketing, entry-level cost is $327 a year.
And who should subscribe?
I think anybody in franchising should subscribe. Anybody. If you're a franchisor, you want to know what franchisees are thinking. If you're a franchisee, you want to know what services and benefits you could get. If you're a franchisee association, you're particularly interested in certain platforms and that you could provide to your members. If you're, of course, trying to sell to franchise systems, you want to subscribe to see what other people are doing. So anybody involved in the franchisee world, and that includes attorneys too, should subscribe and get up to date.
Joe brought up a good point in a message to me. He said he guesses it's both franchise-info.ca and also franchise-info.us. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, that's correct. And again, take a look at the site, International Association of Franchisees and Dealers. Some really great, interesting articles on there. One that I really enjoyed, a New York franchise, Expo Exemption, a Trap for the Unwary Franchisor. Really some good information. And, of course, we see in the title, Michael, international, we see association, we see franchisee, which looks a lot like franchise at a glimpse. So does the IAFD compete with the International Franchise Association?
Well, I think that we all compete for attention. Everybody in the franchise space is competing with everybody else for attention. So in that sense, we're all in competition. But the, you know, we have a particular niche. Our goal is to put together vendors who want to sell their services to franchise systems and want to do so primarily getting the collective, providing collective benefits to franchisees. We're not at all set up to assist franchisors with lobbying, and that seems to be something that the IFA has spent a great deal of money doing, especially recently, lobbying for expanded credit. So if you're a franchisor and you're interested in supporting those lobbying activities, you'll join and support the IFA. If you're interested also in better unit economics and getting your franchisees on a healthier platforms, then you'll support the IFAD. So you'll likely support both. So here's my answer. We're competitors and we're complementers.
Well, great. Michael, I really appreciate you taking the time for being with us again for the third time on our franchise legal series. And Joe, as we wrap up our sixth of seven, give us a quick update on what to expect next week as we talk about the IFA Legal Symposium recap.
Well, we've got Ursa Jackson, an attorney, Texas-based attorney, who's going to be our guest, and she's going to be a great guest for this topic because she is one of the collaborators with the IFA putting together the program for the IFA Legal Symposium. So who better to have talk about what's going to go on there with someone who's helping to plan the event and is going to be deeply involved with it. So we're looking forward to having her tell us what lawyers talk about while they're at the IFA Legal Symposium.
Well, that's great, and looking forward to it. And thanks again for a great show. Until next week, my name is Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.
There we go.